welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Frank Joseph, who is the editor of The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, Compelling Evidence of Ancient Immigrants, Lost Technologies, and Places of Power. Frank is the editor-in-chief, or was the editor-in-chief, of Ancient America magazine from 1993 till his retirement 14 years later, and much of what is in the book comes from things that he discovered during this as editor-in-chief of this publication. And he has published 9 books on the lost civilization of Atlantis and has other titles dealing with archaeology, military history, and metaphysics. So he is very well-educated and has done a lot of research in many of the topics we've discussed on Temple of Health. Welcome, Frank. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, this is an interesting book of, some of the evidence that is presented versus the, you know, the traditional archaeology views of what happened in the Americas, the story of when and where people came from. Would you like to say a little bit for our audience about, how you came to be interested in the topic and how you first discovered that maybe what was in the textbooks wasn't exactly matching up to what people were finding?
Well, that's a good question. It was during my years at Southern Illinois University where I was I had a major in journalism and I had a minor in history. And I hope to someday combine those two, which eventually worked out. Well, in any case, one day I had been traveling from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale on the weekend to St. Louis, Missouri. My friends and I used to go there for fun on the weekends. And on the way to the big city, there was a sign by the side of the road saying Indian Mounds, Cahokia, at this exit. So we never thought much about it because we only expect to see a couple little mounds, you know, maybe about 5 feet high with some Indian burials. Big deal. That's about all. Well, one day we got off the exit, though, because it was a very bad traffic jam. We wanted to waste some time, and we just wanted to see what the mounds look like. Didn't expect much at all. We got off the exit just before the Mississippi River, and we were confronted by a sight that changed our lives. Standing before us was a gigantic pyramid over 100 feet high and greater at its base than the Great Pyramid in Egypt. It was made of 130 million cubic yards of soil, had been completely sheathed in a bright yellow clay, decorated with geometric and solar designs. It was oriented to an astronomical computer that had been built more than 1,000 years ago, specific orientations to the sun, the moon, and various constellations. We were totally shocked. We couldn't imagine that such a thing ever existed in America, let alone in Illinois, across the river from St. Louis. The structure goes back to about 900 A.D.
My goodness.
I went back to my history professor after visiting this. I said, how come you never mentioned anything about Cahokia and Monk's Mound? That's what I refer to as Monk's Mound, named after some Trappist monks who in the 17th century set up shop atop this mound. And he said, well, we know about it, but it isn't all as significant as you think, he said. Not as significant as I think. Here's this structure that rivals the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and we don't hear anything about it. How many of our listeners have ever heard of this magnificent structure? There is now an archaeological museum at its base, not too far, and a lot of work has been done there, but none of this is popularized.
No,
I went to
Washington University in St. Louis. I didn't know about it. I was there for 4 years.
Well, don't feel badly about it because, get this, the former director of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., admitted on television that he had never heard about Monk's Mound and Cahokia
until
the end of his tenure. This is the man that's in charge of all of American prehistory, supposedly.
Right.
I believe that the failure of American education has propelled the existence of things like Ancient American Magazine, and certainly is responsible for books like The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, because these are great treasures. These are tremendous legacies that don't belong to the archaeologists, only they belong to all Americans. It's part of our very rich, unsuspected prehistory. And the main reason why they are not publicized is because they raise some rather inconvenient questions.
Right.
The Native Americans
in the
area.
That's what I was going to ask next. There has to be a reason for that.
Right. The Native Americans in the area, they do not claim that their ancestors built Monk's Mound.
Mm-hmm.
They say that their ancestors were involved very much so in Cahokia when it was thriving in the equivalent to the European Middle Ages, but they did not build it. It was built by foreigners, they say,
mm-hmm.
who pushed up from the south. Well, that's all very heretical, you see. Archaeologists have a mindset, American archaeologists in any case, have a mindset mm-hmm. in which 1492 is a line drawn in the sand, and nobody from the outside world visited America before Columbus. The Americas mm-hmm. were hermetically sealed off, you see, and that no one could have built possibly a ship capable of bridging the Atlantic gap from the old world to the new. And that is dogma. That is a doctrine
mm-hmm.
which is installed in stone in modern archaeology. And we challenge that. And I think books like The Lost Worlds of Ancient America are another crack in the ivory tower of these academics who have, I think, committed cultural transgression against the American people by not letting us know about our past. Well, don't get me started.
Well, you know, your book is full of evidence that it has not been sealed off except for, you know, that 1492 date. And in fact, it even challenges the ideas that there were peoples in not just America, but other places that were maybe not even from this earth. You know, they were very different in terms of what they looked like and what their bone structure was. And, you know, there's just a whole bunch of very interesting information in this book.
Well, you can make what you want of it. I think as a true scientist, you don't condemn any of the information. You may put some
mm-hmm.
of the information aside as, well, I don't understand it just yet,
right.
but you don't throw
right.
it out.
No.
And that's, I think, what we've tried to do. We don't push our ideas on the readers. We would prefer that the readers make up their own minds. But I think what you're referring
mm-hmm.
to are a number of these skulls that have been found in the ancient past, buried in the Americas. These skulls have been elongated in such a way that the skulls today resemble something totally non-human.
Right.
And we do know that skull elongation was practiced by ancient
mm-hmm.
Americans to establish a certain class, a leadership class. They wanted to
mm-hmm.
look physically different than the majority of other people. And why they would go to the trouble of taking a newborn infant and putting its head between two cloth-covered boards and elongating it so that it grows
mm-hmm.
into this oblong shape is very peculiar. Who were they trying to mimic in doing
that's
this?
That's the big question. Why would they do that?
Would they do that? The other
and
interesting
it wasn't
thing
just
is
in
that,
Americas, wasn't it? It wasn't in other places
I was
going to
bring that up. Right.
Yeah.
Head elongation, although it was used in the Americas, was really just as prominent in ancient Egypt during the time
mm-hmm.
of Akhenaten, who was the heretical king of the, known before as Amenhotep IV, and he also had head elongation, which was not common amongst the Egyptians, but nonetheless, his dynasty was into that. He had his daughter's head elongated when they were
mm-hmm.
newborns. It's very peculiar. I don't have the answers for that, but I do know that head elongation, whether it was in Egypt or whether it was in ancient America, was always associated with the elite, with the power,
right. the ruling
people
class.
Are in power. Yeah, interesting.
Right.
There's also an elongated skull, which I had the good luck to see when I was visiting the La Paz Archaeological Museum in Bolivia. It was an
mm-hmm.
extremely extended skull of an adult. The man had lived well into his 50s. But what was incredible to me was not only the skull itself, but he had double rows of teeth, both in his upper and his lower jaw. I mean, the skull did not look like anything what you would call
human.
Very
unusual.
Very unusual. Now, there is a medical phenomena that is occasionally seen where people will have double rows of teeth, usually one jaw or the other. To have double rows and complete teeth, two sets growing simultaneously, that is, I don't know if it's a, as far as I know, it's unheard of. And yet, it belonged to somebody who was really a king or some person of great prominence. And these are, of course, questions that the mainstream does not want you to consider. It opens up all kinds of arguments and conclusions that that they are unable to answer.
There's also evidence, as outlined in your book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, that there was a race of giants that was in the Americas and may have preceded some of the more, traditional Native Americans. Tell me that story. That's good.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because for years I resisted personally any even discussion of giants in the Americas. That seemed to be utterly fantastic. I'd heard about it, people claiming that, oh, yeah, there were these giants who roamed the Americas, you know, long before the first Europeans arrived. And I thought that was just too much to accept. Well, I was totally wrong. archaeologists, conventional archaeologists now admit that a race of what you can only refer to as giants had a highly advanced civilization here in North America beginning about 1,000 years before Christ, a 3,000-year-old civilization, which is referred to as the Edina. And the proof of this is abundant. A number of these so-called Edina burial mounds that have been opened have been found to contain the skeletal remains of a lost race who bear no resemblance whatsoever to Native Americans, and but do bear some relationship to some Europeans. But nonetheless, these skeletal remains, the tallest woman found so far, was 6'9", or 6 feet 10 inches tall. That's pretty tall for a woman of any race. But the tallest man found so far, it's incredible, is 7 feet 8 inches high. However, the new documentation has now come out thanks to Fritz Zimmermann. Fritz Zimmermann is the world's leading expert on ancient earthworks in the Americas, concentrating in the Midwest. This man has produced a book as an encyclopedia that is just definitive. And he has unearthed a report, a late 19th century report, in which the mayor of a town in Ohio, together with, I think, local physicians, were able to excavate, as hard as this is to believe, the remains of men and women who were 9 feet tall. Now, I found all this incredibly hard to believe, but it is the fact now. There's a mainstream archaeologist by the name of Dragoo, D-R-A-G-O-O. He's written a number of textbooks about American prehistory. And he also talks about these mounds that were opened, and you're finding the remains commonly of men who are well over 7 feet tall and some eight-footers. These belong to a people that are known to the Ojibwa Indians in myth. They are called the Yom Kodesh, which means, literally, the red-haired giant sorcerers. And these people appeared on the scene in America. They were the first agriculturalists. They introduced agriculture. They were the first metallurgists. They had iron foundries. And they show no previous long-term development. They just are here. They are somewhat similar. The only people you can find similar to them are the Celts of ancient Europe, which also had great stature, although none of them got to be 8 feet tall. Certainly none were 9 feet, none were 9 feet tall. These people called the Edina, that's their scientific name. We don't know exactly what they called themselves. These people also practiced head elongation. Not as much as the Maya or other peoples, but nonetheless, they did practice head elongation also. The name of this people is probably similar to the name Allegheny. The name Allegheny is another Ojibwa term. It refers to the people of the mountains or the people of the rivers. And their name may be, some people think it might be Alawegi or Aleg, something like that. But Allegheny is about the closest we can go. And these people created a civilization that lasted for 700 years. That's unbelievable. They were the power center of North America from the Mississippi to the eastern seaboard, and parts of the U.S. South, but they were concentrated primarily in the Ohio Valley, had great power in Pennsylvania and New York. It's a remarkable people, and they were literally exterminated. We have the excellent physical and oral evidence for their demise. The Native Americans formed a coalition, and the ancestors of the Ojibwa drove the last of the Allegheny or the Alegwe to the falls of the Ohio in upper in northern Kentucky. And there, myth says that the last of the red-haired giant sorcerers, the Yom Kodesh, were exterminated, men, women, and children. And it's at the falls of the Ohio that a bone field has been found, a killing field. And all of the skulls that have been found, most of them are not elongated because they probably represent working and warrior class people. But all of the skulls have been found with blunt force trauma. Very interesting. It's a great story, and we outline it somewhat in The Lost Worlds of Ancient America.
And it makes you wonder, too, that perhaps what happened to the Native Americans when the settlers came from Europe that wasn't karmic.
You know, you're not the first person that has brought that up, interestingly enough. And the Native Americans themselves kind of indicated that, because the falls of the Ohio that I mentioned, where there's this killing field, was strictly avoided by all Native American tribes. It was cursed ground.
Yeah, didn't they say the spirits were there and were very active? The spirits of the giants were there.
Well,
I remember
Ojibwa tradition
like
today still speaks about that area as being a rather cursed area.
Right.
So it's interesting. Yeah. When the Allegheny were destroyed, when they were liquidated, North America fell into a dark ages of barbarism, in which one tribe fought another, and many tribes perished, were literally wiped out. And when the Europeans arrived, they arrived really right in the middle of this incredible warfare that was going on amongst the Native American tribes.
You know, had they been a coalition at that time, things might have been very different.
Well,
had the Native Americans been more of a coalition?
The Native American tribes did form a coalition to wipe out the Adena or the Allegheny. That's true.
But we don't know why they hadn't been infighting. Yeah.
Lots of infighting, exactly.
Interesting. So, where do you think they came from? Do you think they came from Atlantis across the sea, the seafaring giants that were talked about?
No, I don't believe so. The arrival of the Allegheny on the eastern seaboard of the United States or North America took place about 1000 BC. This would be long after the supposed destruction of Atlantis. I don't believe that these Yom Kodesh or the Adena were Atlanteans, but it appears that they were at least partially related to the Celts of Western Europe, because the Celts were known not only for their red hair and for their great stature, although not as tall as here, but they were also known as great iron workers and great seafarers. Most people assume that the Celts were just the enemies of Rome, which is true. But Caesar, in his book on the Gallic Wars, tells about a naval battle that Roman forces had to fight against the Celtic fleets. And the Celtic seafarers had much larger ships, maybe because the Celts themselves were larger than the little Romans. They actually had battleships. There were Celtic battleships. And it was only because of superior Roman military science that the sea battle was won by Caesar. So I believe that the Celts had not only the maritime ability to cross here, but the Celts were also a very restless people. They originated mm-hmm. in what is now the steppes of central Russia, and they spread all over Western Europe. They were always on the move, very vigorous mm-hmm. people, and a wild warrior-like people, and that's pretty much how the Adena or the Yom Kodesh are described here in North America. Mm-hmm.
I had heard earlier, I didn't really see too much in your book, but I had heard that the Vikings had also at least come to North America by ship.
Well, there is super abundant evidence for the impact of the Norse on North America that is beyond question. And the most controversial artifact of the Norse in North America, and there are, by the way, dozens, maybe hundreds of Norse artifacts all across mm-hmm. mostly the American Middle West, strangely enough, and the, mm-hmm. again, the Eastern Seaboard. The most controversial artifact of them all is called the Kensington Runestone. The Kensington Runestone was found in November 1898, by a farmer who was plowing his freshly bought land in central Minnesota. And he was uprooting a tree, an aspen tree, when he found entwined in its roots a 300-pound slab, boulder. And the boulder was inscribed on two sides with runic writing. Runes are the letter form that was used by the medieval Scandinavian people that they had inherited mm-hmm. From Gothic people and so on long before. And the runic text on this stone was handily translated. It was translated from medieval Swedish, and it basically told the story of an exploration group, a mixed group of Gotlanders and Swedes, who arrived in what is now Minnesota, and they tried to establish a land claim in that area, and they fell afoul of Native Americans. Again, mm-hmm. People unable to get along with one another, things end in bloodshed. And this story is retold on this stone. When the stone was first discovered by this simple farmer, the stone was immediately attacked by conventional archaeologists as being a fraud, as a hoax.
Right, yeah.
And all throughout the 20th century, the rest of the 19th, and throughout the 20th century and into the early 21st century, the Kensington Runestone was regarded as a joke, as just a hoax mm-hmm. that the farmer had perpetrated, even though the farmer went to his deathbed saying that the stone was authentic.
He had no ruins, right?
It was a remarkable story. But anyway, mainstream archaeologists, in all the textbooks where the Kensington Runestone is mentioned at all, it's mm-hmm. just a big fake, that's all.
So
even
what
though there
year
was never
would
any
that
money
have been?
Involved and nobody profited by it. Matter of fact, people suffered yeah. because of association
oh, yeah.
with the stone. In any
so
case,
what year would you say that was, the time period of that?
That the runestone refers to?
Yeah, what time period?
Well, we have the date literally inscribed on the stone
itself. Oh, okay,
itself.
So we know.
It's 1362.
Okay.
Now, in 1362, okay. the Viking Age had ended, although mm-hmm. Norse exploration was still ongoing. The Norse by 1362, the Scandinavians, had been completely Christianized.
Mm-hmm.
But that period is very interesting because in the mid-14th century, there was a major plague all over northern Europe. And Scandinavia was particularly hard hit. And we do know of a king by the name of Knutsson in Sweden who dispatched in the early 14th century a voyage of exploration to find some place where he and his family could go as a refuge to get away from the plagues that were ravaging his kingdom.
Probably a good idea.
Until they passed. You know? And, but
continent.
Even with that parallel information, the archaeologist said, no, it's just fake.
Hmm.
In 2007, which is not very long ago, a very brilliant man by the name of Scott Walter, who is a university-trained geologist, was given the Kensington Runestone to determine if the inscription could be shown through modern geological testing, whether it was a fake or whether it was authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Walter knew nothing about the Kensington Runestone, had no interest in archaeology whatsoever. The stone was presented to him specifically because he is an award-winning geologist. He owns his own laboratory. He's the president of his mm-hmm. own laboratory in St. Paul, Minnesota. So he's quite right. well-respected.
Mm-hmm.
And the laboratory has the state-of-the-art equipment for determining things like the authenticity or lack thereof associated mm-hmm. with the Kensington runestone. So after some months of testing, Scott Walter released his report, in which he demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that the inscription on the Kensington runestone and the weathering plus the mineralization that had taken place on the stone, mm-hmm. surface of the stone itself indicated that it could have only been carved sometime in the 14th or 15th century, that it was by mm-hmm. no means a modern fake. There were no modern tool marks on it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about this is that after Scott Walter released his geological report for peer review by his fellow geologists, they universally accepted his assessment as entirely correct. It was a consensus opinion. All mm-hmm. of the geologists said that he had followed procedures as expected and that his results were unequivocal, that the inscription mm-hmm. could have only been made, the geological testing showed, hundreds mm-hmm. of years before the stone was found in the late 19th century. But the archaeologists, when they were presented with this information,
mm-hmm.
refused to give it any peer review. They just fell back on what they had always been saying, that right. it was a kind of a folk art joke, that the mm-hmm. Kensington runestone was beneath contempt or for even serious study. Well, that is the, I think, reflects very poorly on the state of modern American archaeology, that they wouldn't even consider the findings of a university-trained, highly respected, award-winning geologist who was backed up by all of his colleagues. And so today, even though this discovery was made back in 2007,
mm-hmm.
no textbooks have been revised saying yes, that the Norse were here long before Columbus, that they had come not only to the shores of North America, but had come as far inland as Minnesota.
That's a long way.
And traveled through the Great Lakes region.
Yeah, that's a long way.
I think that the Kensington runestone is one of the artifacts that is discussed mm-hmm. in The Lost Worlds of Ancient America.
Yeah, and you also talk about Roman coins. I found that interesting. Roman coins being found all over the place in America. And
I guess
regular archaeologists will just say that they're just there and they're there because somebody put them there having been a collector, but you address
well,
that.
Well, what the archaeologists say about these Roman coins that have been found, not dozens, but literally hundreds of authentic Roman coins have been found all over the Midwest. Interestingly enough,
mm-hmm.
most of them, as far as I know, all of them have been found east of the Mississippi. They've
mm-hmm.
not been found on west of the Mississippi. And mainstream archaeologists will say, well, these Roman coins that are being found are planted there sometimes just to fool us, to make us scientists look bad. And or else they're just loose change. You see, there's these pneumaticists that have all these rare Roman coins, and they just have holes in their pockets or something, and they happen to drop them. They happen to lose them all over. The very concept that ancient Romans could have been here,
it doesn't enter their thinking.
It's it can't exist. Therefore, yeah. it does not exist. That's how their training is on this.
That reminds me of
our listeners, Don. Yeah.
It reminds me of
for
saying,
our listeners to understand
mm-hmm.
that America was a melting pot long before the Statue of Liberty was erected in New York Harbor, that many people throughout the ancient past have come here for various agendas, for different
mm-hmm.
things they wanted. America has always been, the Americas have always been places of great abundance, agricultural and mineralogical abundance, and places of refuge. And the ancients understood that. It was, however, information to get here was considered very secret. If you're going to a place of refuge, you don't want somebody who's persecuting you to follow you there. And also, if you have a place of great wealth, you don't want other people to know about it. And that's one reason why a lot of the information that we're finding out now was really kind of privileged information. It's the same thing as kind of an industrial secret, where one company will keep a secret from another because that's privileged information. The Roman coins are still being found. We have an excellent article by Lee Pennington. And Lee Pennington is a Pulitzer Prize nominee. He's hardly a fool. And he has presented, I think, one of the best articles ever written about the Roman coins, and a recent find that was made in the Ohio Valley that was found on a riverbank not too far from his home, as a matter of fact. So he makes a very superb case for Roman coins found in the Americas. He also mentions the discovery of Roman amphora, or storage jars, that have been found by the dozens in Rio de Janeiro. So there's no doubt that the Romans were here, and they came for very specific purposes.
And they left more than coins. You talk about the swords that were found. I mean,
well,
I think
one of the things that they left that was indelible, I think, is I'm talking about people from the ancient old world.
Mm-hmm.
They left an impact on the Native Americans themselves that is still traceable today. When there was a DNA study that was made of all Native American tribes, it was completed about 5 or 7 years ago. And the DNA study showed that certain American tribes, not all of them, not even most of them, but certain Native American tribes, like the Ojibwe that I mentioned, have genetic roots in the Near East. How about that? A tribe specifically that was studied quite well was the Cherokee of eastern Tennessee. And the DNA of the eastern Tennessee Cherokee shows that their ancestors are from Israel, or what is today Israel, in the Near East. Now, this is genetic information that is not theoretical. I mean, this is data that is beyond question, and yet, again, it doesn't seem to leach into the textbooks somehow.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you mentioned in your book, but there was also a book written about the Chinese having sailed, you know, to the West Coast before Columbus landed on.
Yes, you're referring to an excellent book by Galvin Menzies. And Galvin Menzies has done a tremendous amount of work showing the impact that was made by Imperial China on the Americas centuries before Columbus was born, let alone sailed the Atlantic Ocean to San Salvador. We don't discuss the Chinese too much in this particular book. We do mention the impact of Imperial China on the west coast of America in a previous volume. I should mention that The Lost Worlds of Ancient America is the third in a three-volume set dealing with these overseas contacts in the Americas. The previous one is called Unearthing Ancient America. That book is still available. And there are some wonderful Chinese artifacts that have been found and documented in the United States are discussed and photographed.
Great. Yeah. So it looks like from every direction we've had, you know, explorers come, and some settled, some probably didn't settle. You know, some probably just visited and went back.
Well, some came. But there's no doubt that some arrived here as castaways. That's only inevitable that would happen.
Yeah.
However, we're not really particularly interested in these occasional visitors to North America or the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we cite is the effect that ancient Egypt had in the Americas. In this present volume, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, we have an article by Dr. Gunnar Thompson, or rather about Dr. Gunnar Thompson, if I remember correctly. It's written by Wayne May, who's the publisher of Ancient American Magazine. And he describes the work of Dr. Gunnar Thompson, who is a university-trained archaeologist. However, he's a maverick. He does not go along with the mainstream. And Dr. Thompson, when he was visiting Egypt some years ago, he was in the south of Egypt called the Upper Nile Valley, and he was visiting a magnificent temple that had been built by Queen Hatshepsut about 1,500 years before Christ. And this great temple is perfectly preserved, and on the side of the temple is a sculpted frieze, which depicts an expedition that Queen Hatshepsut had launched during her reign. And this expedition had returned to Egypt with all kinds of strange goods, foods and animals and so on. And it shows in this frieze on her temple to this day, you can still see, it shows a line of stevedores carrying these trays. And on the trays appear to be corn, ears of corn. Well, that's interesting because corn does not grow in Egypt, doesn't grow anywhere in North Africa, anywhere in Africa at all.
Right.
Moreover, the corn resembles a type of corn that is seen specifically in a strain that's seen in North America. So Dr. Thompson went to botanists, and was able to determine that, in fact, the corn portrayed on the site of Queen Hatshepsut's temple is, in fact, a strain of North American corn, grows only in North America.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have an example, one amongst several, that shows that the Egyptians came specifically to the Americas for corn. They went to South America for cocaine, interestingly enough. In our earlier book that I mentioned called The Lost Unearthing Ancient America, we have an article about the traffic in cocaine that the ancient Egyptians were involved in. More than 4,000 years ago, they sailed to Peru and to Ecuador. And we know that because beginning in the 1990s, a number of Egyptian mummies, when x-rays were being made of them, were found to contain residues of cocaine. Cocaine also does not grow in Egypt or anywhere in Africa at all. Cocaine grows only in northern states of South America. The Egyptians sailed specifically to South America for cocaine for medical purposes and probably also for religious purposes to achieve altered states of consciousness. They didn't use recreational drugs like degenerates in the United States use it. Cocaine was imported into the Nile Valley specifically for medical and spiritual purposes. And the number of Egyptian mummies that have been found to contain cocaine residue is in the dozens, at least. Again, this information was disclosed in the early 1990s, but it is avoided by mainstream archaeologists. This excellent material proof that the Egyptians were here and traded regularly for cocaine.
Now, when you say cocaine residue, do you mean that they actually buried cocaine with the mummy?
No, the mummies in life used cocaine. The mummies, when the mummified bodies preserved the cocaine residue.
And that was they do drug testing.
While it was alive, was taking
the residue.
Cocaine.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because I'm trying to think, why would you test a mummy for cocaine?
Don't
I guess it
test
was
a mummy for cocaine. The X-rays were being done on the mummies to medical X-rays to determine cause of death, diet, all kinds of conditions that would reflect on the state of society at the time these people were alive. And during these exhaustive tests, the
somebody
amount
tested
of cocaine
for cocaine.
That was, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, though. But that's an excellent way to find out where people have been.
Right, and we're living in a great time in this regard, that the technology now is advancing so thoroughly and quickly, especially in the use of DNA and genetic research, that a lot of these pieces of information that were completely unknown before are now being disclosed. We had to depend before entirely on the archaeologists for understanding the ancient past, but now other sciences, hard sciences like genetics and geology, are revealing things that we had no suspicion of before. And as a consequence, America's prehistory is turning out to be a far more dramatic and interesting episode in the past than previously suspected.
When do you think this is going to break out and end up changing the textbooks? What do you think is going to do it? Books
well,
like you're writing?
I think general consensus is that only after this generation of mainstream archaeologists has passed away and younger people, more open to alternative points of view, are becoming charged, that more of this will be finally recognized. There is actually a change going on now. When we first started our magazine, Ancient American, back in 1993, mm-hmm. mainstream archaeologists absolutely demanded to acceptance of the idea that there were no human beings in the Americas before maybe only 9,000 years ago, 9 to 12,000 years ago maximum, and that they mm-hmm. only could have arrived here over a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska. Well, that paradigm has shifted, even in the last 20 years or so, where now mainstream archaeologists are saying, no, we're finding too much information which shows that people were here a lot longer than that, and that many of them arrived by sea. That would have been considered absolutely heretical to say such a thing back in the early 1990s, but now mainstream archaeologists are tending more to think, well, maybe 13, 15,000 years ago. Well, if you make that concession, hey, look at this. Here's somebody that was mm-hmm. here 500,000 years ago. What do you think about that?
Yeah.
So, but the fact that they're admitting contact by sea is remarkable. So I think that we are in a period of transition, a period of change. And I do not believe that the history and the prehistory of America will be taught the same way at the end of this century the way it's being taught now.
Well, if you think about it, if Noah was able to build an ark that could survive a worldwide flood, why couldn't the shipbuilders build ships that could get to the Americas? Does it make
sense?
Well,
consider
this.
A society like ancient Egypt, which could build the Great Pyramid, which cannot be reproduced today, this magnificent work of engineering art. Yet people that could do this, we're told, were too dumb to make a boat that would cross the North Atlantic. I mean, that does not make
sense.
But then again, archaeologists are not known for making a lot of sense.
Well, you wrote a chapter 35 in here. It's called The Mystery and the Sphere, authored by yourself. And you talk about Central America's monumental stone balls. You want to talk a little bit about that and how that is just more evidence that whoever was here weren't, you know, savages. They weren't, you know, they had technology that was fairly advanced and maybe, you know, more advanced than the Native Americans that we know of, you know.
These stone spheres of Costa Rica that you're referring to mm-hmm. are the most mysterious objects in the entire book, probably the entire world. Most of our listeners are probably unaware that there are some 300 massive stone balls that have been found mostly, almost exclusively, in Costa Rica. The first one was found by accident by the United Fruit Company back in the late 1930s. It was an American firm. They were clearing some area for a plantation when they came across what looked like some round objects coming out of the ground. Well, they excavated the thing, and they found that it was a stone sphere, solid stone, weighed something like 6.5 tons, was about 7 feet in diameter, and that it had been carved. It had been shaped beautifully with incredible precision. It's virtually impossible today to make a stone ball of such exactitude. If you go to a stone cutter today and you give them, say, a 10-ton block of stone, say, you know, I'd like this turned into a stone sphere with the same kind of perfection that we find in the Costa Rican stones, you know, he may turn you down. And mm-hmm. yet these stone spheres that have been found in the dozens now, they still find them. Some of them are only about the size of grapefruit, and others are quite large. Some of these stones are on islands just off the coast of Costa Rica, which would indicate that whoever made these things also were in possession of large ships. You don't load up something like a 12-ton stone sphere in a birch bark canoe.
On a raft.
You know, you've got to have a ship. You've got to have a freighter to bring
big
that thing out
ship,
to an island that's 19 miles away. Now, who built these things and why? Nobody knows. But the more that we do know about these stones, we do know some facts about them. Mm-hmm. The stone that was used, they were carved from, wasn't even local. It came from the other side of a high mountain range. So just transporting tons, mm-hmm. hundreds of tons of stone over these mountains, these precipitous mountains on the other side, and then carving them with incredible precision, and then burying them. They were not monuments. There are no burials associated with them. These stones were crafted and then deliberately buried. All of them have been deliberately buried. None of them have been left out to mark anything, although mm-hmm. some are in peculiar arrangements. Some are arranged in a triangular fashion. Others of them are next to the seashore. Others are far inland. Nobody knows what they were used for. But they do indicate, we can conclude, that only a highly advanced society, far more advanced than what the society that we know was there, could have possibly made these. There are two native peoples that are in this area, and the only material achievements that these people seem to have come up with were like fish hooks made out of mussel shells. You know, it's a long way to go from that, to building
a
12-ton,
7-foot stone ball.
Sphere.
My goodness, yeah, that is just amazing. Now,
I mean, I
never
amazing.
Heard of these.
It is truly amazing.
Yeah.
What I've done in that book is, in this chapter on the Costa Rican spheres, I put in everything that's known mm-hmm. about them and tried to make some kind of deductions.
Mm-hmm.
And people, of course, are always wondering, well, why would anybody go to this trouble? I make mm-hmm. a conclusion which is radical, admittedly,
mm-hmm.
and I don't even know if it's true. Just because it's plausible doesn't mean it's true. But
true.
You have to take into account the stone ball's placement. They are mostly in Costa Rica, which is a
mm-hmm.
highly active seismic area of the world. They have earthquakes
mm-hmm.
going on there constantly. Some of them are substantial, most of them are not, but it's a really active area tectonically.
Mm-hmm.
The stone balls themselves are made up of a kind of a crystalline matrix. They have lots of crystal in them. Well, if you take crystal, quartz crystal, and you submit it to mechanical force, you squeeze it, what results is an electronic discharge. You may have
mm-hmm.
heard of the old crystal radio sets. When you turned on a crystal radio in the 1920s, that dial, that knob that you turned, really was a vice that squeezed a little crystal inside the radio. And when it squeezed it sufficiently, it produced a spark, and that spark turned the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is it possible that people long ago also understood this technology, that they buried these crystalline balls, that they really are crystal, I suppose. You can kind of call them a crystal balls,
mm-hmm.
yeah, crystal spheres, and that the tectonic force exerting itself on these crystals, did they exert some kind of electrical discharge? Why would they do such a thing? But it's an interesting possible relationship, and I leave it to the reader to take it from there.
Well, my thoughts on it is that it obviously is something technological. I mean, that it has to be. It has to be some
You're
technology
right.
that we
don't
understand.
You're right. It is technological because there are no indications of there's no
yeah.
petroglyphs on them. There
right,
no lighting
nothing.
On them. Nothing. There yeah. are no structures associated with them. They are just
mm-hmm.
there. I think you're right. I think they are evidence of a lost technology.
Yeah, and an energy producing technology would be definitely something that would be useful. And I know there's other theories out there that perhaps some of the pyramids were also involved in energy production.
That's right. There's a wonderful book by a good friend of mine, Christopher Dunn. He's written a book called The Giza Power Plant. And
yeah, I read that. That's
a
great book.
He is, of course, a machinist himself. He runs his own company
mm-hmm.
in Danville, Illinois, machining company. He's a brilliant man. And he also shows that the true identity of the Great Pyramid is a kind of a solid-state machine.
Right.
It's an incredible supposition to make, but I think his arguments are very solid. Very strong. And I believe that
whenever I see anything that is absolutely, you know, incredible, and also the simple design of it, you know, if you look at the design of things that are more art and religion based, they tend to be very ornate and very complicated. But in technology, things are simple. You know, they're spheres and pyramids and cubes and, you know, I mean, look at any technology that we have, you know, that we've developed. It's not ornate. It's practical.
That's right. No, that's a really good observation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's correct. There's nothing really, well, the Great Pyramid itself, there have been no art forms.
No bodies.
Found in the Great Pyramid.
No mummies.
No hieroglyphs in the Great Pyramid.
Right. Yeah. So that's what you have to look
at. Because it's a machine. We don't decorate our machines.
No.
With
artwork. Well, there'd be no reason to. They're there to produce power or to be capacitors or, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that energy is you know, either revved up or revved down, and none of it is complicated. You know,
it would appear that if in fact these stone spheres in Costa Rica did serve a technological purpose, and if there is in fact an electrical component to them, it would appear that they didn't use them as we would think for electrical power or lights or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They may have, we don't know, but I believe
well,
that that's probably not the
case. Whatever connected them might be long gone, you know. I mean, the stone survived, but other things might not
have
survived.
The thing about electrical discharge is that it has an effect on human consciousness. It's a thing known as ion therapy today, which is based on electrical discharge. And ion therapy is used to treat patients who otherwise have an allergic reaction to normal anesthesia. And when someone is subjected to ion therapy, they often experience visions. They're not just sedated. They go through altered states of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that these stone spheres were used specifically for that reason, to create a field of altered consciousness so that persons entering into this area would be able to communicate with the gods, as it were.
Right.
That's a possibility.
Kind of like a crop circle, but permanent. You know, the effects of a crop circle.
In any case, we're dealing with a highly advanced people.
Yeah.
Could be thousands of years ago, not just centuries ago.
Right.
Who were in possession of technology that we now only in the
21st
century.
We don't even understand. Right.
Just beginning to think about. That would have seemed totally magical before the 21st century.
Well, you have written some other interesting books, The Atlantis Encyclopedia and Opening the Ark of the Covenant. You have been just very busy exploring great
mysteries.
Well,
I have. This is my life. I've devoted myself to investigating these problems. And I consider myself a reporter. I'm not an archaeologist, although I've been on numerous archaeological digs and dives, and I do archaeological work. But mostly, I guess I'm a science reporter. My background is in journalism, and so my job is to investigate these questions and to lay them out for the general public.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Would you like to give the audience your contact information and anything else you want to tell them before we close up?
Sure. If they're interested in my latest book, which is The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, we've been discussing today, they can get copies from Amazon.com, or they can go directly to my website, which is www.ancientamerican.com. And you have contact information there. Just dial that up, and you'll be able to contact me.
Great. And if you have any other books that you would like to talk about, I know this is your latest one, but if you have other ones, just send them our way and we'll get you back on.
Oh, we'd love to do that. I've got another one coming out next spring. It's called Before Atlantis. And it's
Wonderful. That's about when we're booking, by the
Atlantis.
Way.
Long before.
Yeah. Well, that's I would love to do that one. I think that the more we know about our history, the more we're going to understand about why we have the problems we have, especially warfare, inability to get along, you know, problems that we are actually still grappling with, in the world.
I absolutely agree with you. I think the best way to understand what's happening now is the better appreciation of the past.
It is. It really is. Those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it.
Well, we seem to be doing that right now, don't we?
Santana or somebody said that. Yeah, I don't know exactly who, but I
know
that was
actually.
Yeah, there you go, Santana. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a delightful interview, and I look forward to talking with you about your book coming out in the spring. It's Before Atlantis. Is that the name of it?
That's right. It's called Before Atlantis, and it deals with human evolution. There's been some new things found there, that in the course of our evolution, we appear to have made a very important detour into the sea, and there was an aquatic mm-hmm. phase that was responsible for us being what we are now.
Well, I definitely want to read that. That's new material. I love new material.
A little different. Well, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to discuss this with you, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
We will. We'll get you set up. We've been interviewing Frank Joseph on his book, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, Compelling Evidence of Ancient Immigrants, Lost Technologies, and Places of Power. This is a great book that I would highly recommend as you know, we've been exploring a lot of things beyond health, but of course, if we're going to understand who we are, we need to look at our history. Thanks so much, Frank, for joining us. I really appreciate it. Next week we will have, Touchstone Moments, Golden Nuggets on a Shaman's Path, and then Dr. Amit Goswami will be with us the next week. God is not dead. What quantum physics tells us about our origins and how we should live. And then Nancy Redstar's book, Star Ancestors, Extraterrestrial Contact in the Native American Tradition, which I'm sure Frank knows a little bit about. She'll be on the 1st of December. Thanks so much for joining us. Lorraine Eldridge will be giving our Noetic Science, which is the third Thursday, which is the 18th. No, that's not true. That's the... Anyway, it's the third Thursday in November. She'll be talking about Clarinian photography and how we can measure energy systems beyond our physical body. Thanks so much, Frank, for joining us. And please, everybody, join us next week for another Temple of Health.